We set the stage for exploring Judges last week, and we're going to move into chapter 1 today. Now, what we're going to see is a rapid slide of Israel from a pinnacle of success and accomplishment and, more importantly, harmony with God into an every-man-for-himself attitude. And when I say rapid, I'm speaking of a period of probably only 10 to 15 years after Joshua passed away, before the 12 tribes began losing their way. We need to digest an interesting reality of Israel's history that is one of those little factoids that can give us a better perspective of what life was like for them, and it helps us to understand what was underlying Israel's history, especially between the times of Joshua and King Josiah, who ruled over Judah from 640 to 609 BC. It was that exceedingly few copies of the Torah were created, and they certainly did not wind up in the hands of any ordinary citizen. In fact, it appears that by the time of King David, around 300 to 400 years after Joshua's death, the Torah was all but lost. It was well on its way to being forgotten. And once the tribes dispersed in earnest around Canaan, started to take a firmer hold in their allotted territories, the priesthood struggled to exist, let alone have any significant influence. The roles of the priest and Levite tabernacle workers blurred. Only a few of the 48 cities that the Levites were promised within the tribal territories were ever actually handed over. And the funding they were to receive from those same tribes to maintain themselves in those cities rarely sufficed. The tabernacle at the time of chapter 1 in Judges resided in Shiloh, but it would steadily go into disrepair over the decades. By King David's day, it was moved to Gibeon. Now, tents by definition are temporary and they wear out rather quickly as compared to stone huts. While we might ask ourselves how much it could possibly cost to maintain a tent, we must remember their rather elaborate nature of this one, the super expensive materials used, the number of exceptional craftsmen required to make it originally. All one has to do to get an understanding of this sad progression of things is go to England and witness the disheveled condition of many grand churches and cathedrals as a result of a dying Christianity that first lost interest and then lost their faith. Thus, when King David asked Jehovah if he could build a temple to the Lord, and his son Solomon finally did, it was not actually to replace the wilderness tabernacle per se, because the ancient one had long since been abandoned due to its wearing out and apparently no desire to repair it. Rather, it was that there was in existence no properly built sanctuary under the Mount Sinai specifications. David apparently built some type of tent to house the ark, and I'm sure it was far more than some Bedouin-looking affair. But David also took upon himself to appoint Levites and priests to do certain duties. So we can assume that the order of service and the careful attention to detail wasn't all that kosher anymore. And very likely there were but a few among the remnant of priests who even remembered just how to properly observe the rituals and the procedures. Well, we get some idea of how inconsequential and impotent the priesthood had become when we look at the story of the ark being brought from Beit Shemesh to King David at his request, and it was placed unceremoniously into an ox cart to transport it. That's a king-size no-no. Then a man touched the ark, another no-no. And he died from it, which, when David heard about it, caused David to get so paranoid, He changed his mind about having the ark anywhere near him. And he asked a Levite, not a Kohen, not a priest, named Obed-Edom to keep the ark in his home, which, by the way, is another serious infraction. Yet, for reasons we're not going to get into today, we are told that the Lord greatly blessed Obed-Edom's household as a result of the ark residing there. So David decided it was not only safe but also advantageous to him personally to possess the ark. So he called for it now to be brought to Jerusalem, and there he prepared a tent to house it. We see from all this that the priesthood simply took orders, that it was barely functioning, if at all, and that even the most basic of all rules that one could ever look upon the Ark of the Covenant or to touch it, that meant instant death, all this had been lost to history. We see that a phrase repeated a few times in the book of Judges, Shoftim in Hebrew, is that in these days there was no king, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. That sums up the time period of the judges. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And if that just sums it up and tells us to be very careful. Very careful. Let's read Judges chapter 1. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's on page 270. Judges chapter 1. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel asked Adonai, "Who will go up for us first to fight against the Canaanites?" Adonai said, "Judah will go up. Here, I have handed the land over to him." And Judah said to his brother Simeon, "Come up with me into my assigned territory so that we can fight against the Canaanites. And Lila will likewise go with you into your territory." So Shimon went with him, and Judah went up, and Adonai gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and of those in Bezek they killed 10,000 men. They found Adonai Bezek in Bezek, and they fought against him. They killed the Canaanites and the Perizzites, but Adonai Bezek fled. They pursued him, caught him, cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off gathered food under my table. God has paid me back in accordance with what I did." They brought him to Jerusalem and he died there. Then the people of Judah fought against Jerusalem, captured it, overpowered it with the sword, and set the city on fire. Afterwards, the people of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, who lived in the hill country in the Negev and in the Shephelah. Judah also attacked the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiryat Arba, and they overpowered Sheshai, Achman, and Talmai. From there, they attacked the inhabitants of Debir. Debir was formerly called Kiryat Sefer. Caleb said, "To whoever overpowers Kiryat Sefer and captures it, I will give my daughter Achsah as his wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it. So he gave him Achsah, his daughter, as his wife. After becoming his wife, she persuaded him to ask her father to give him a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What do you want?" And she said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you gave me land in the Negev, also give me sources of water." So Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Next, the descendants of the Cainei, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of date palms with the people of Judah into the Judah desert south of Arad, and they came and settled with the people. Judah went on with Shimon, his brother, and they overpowered the Canaanites who inhabited Sfat and completely destroyed it. The name of the city was called Hormah. Judah also took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, Ekron with its territory. Adonai was with Judah, and they took possession of the hillside country because they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley since they had iron chariots. They gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said to do, and he drove out from there the three sons of Anak. The people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. Rather, the Jebusites continued living with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem as they do to this day. The house of Joseph likewise attacked Beth El, and Adonai was with them. The house of Joseph sent spies to Beth El. The city was formerly called Luz. The spy saw a man coming up out of the city and said to him, "Please show us the way to enter the city and we'll treat you kindly." So he showed them the way into the city, and they overpowered the city with the sword, but they let the man and all his family go free. He went into the land of the Hittim, built a city, and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beit Shan and its villages, Tanakh and its villages, Dor and its villages, Yivleam and its villages, or Megiddo and its villages. So the Canaanites managed to keep on living in that land. In time when Israel had grown strong, they did put the Canaanites to forced labor, but failed to drive them out completely. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, so the Canaanites continued living in Gezer along with them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or Nahalol, so the Canaanites continued to live among them, but became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko, Sidon, Achlav, Aksiv, Helba, Afik, or Rehov. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites who were living in the land because they didn't drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beit Shemesh or Beit Anat, but lived among the Canaanites living in the land. However, the inhabitants of Beit Shemesh and Beit Anat became forced labor for them. The Amorites forced the people of Dan into the hills, for they would not let them come down to the valley. The Amorites had resolved to live in the Heres Hills, in Ayalon and in Sha'alvim, but when the power of the house of Joseph grew greater, they became subject to forced labor. So the territory of the Amorites was from the scorpion ascent and the rock upward. There's an important purpose to the book of Judges that is almost universally missed. It is that God was demonstrating the need for a king over Israel. Many, including myself not that long ago, have kind of reflexively said that with Samuel's anointing of King Saul, the Lord gave to Israel something he did not want to give them, a king. But an honest reading of Judges shows us something different. In reality, the Lord was teaching Israel they couldn't function without a king. They could not, or perhaps would not, follow God's laws and commandments without a king. Joshua wasn't officially a king, but in many ways that was his role. He was Jehovah's definition of a king that is diametrically opposed to man's definition of a king. Joshua was the example of ideal leadership for Israel. One they failed to follow, one that won't come again until Messiah returns. Man's definition of a king is as privileged royalty who is served by his subjects who usually don't have much choice in the matter. God's definition of a king is as a shepherd who is a kind of servant to those who have chosen to follow him by their own free will. Mankind's kings use human shields, consisting of thousands of men who would lay down their lives for the benefit of the king. God's king lays down his life for the benefit of the people. The problem with Israel was that eventually they wanted their and their neighbor's definition of a king to rule over them. And so the Lord gave them one. It was the type of king, not the idea of being ruled by a king, that would become the issue. Verse 1 says that after Joshua died, the people asked Jehovah an important question. Who would be the first to do battle with the Canaanites? This was not a rhetorical question. During Joshua's day and for a brief period at the beginning of the rule of the various Shoftim, asking or inquiring of the Lord meant that the Urim and Thummim were used to seek his will. And of course, this could only have happened when the high priest was still performing his official role and when the tribal leader still recognized the high priest's God-ordained purpose and position. The answer the Lord gave through the two special stones was Judah would be that tribe to resume battle to finish the conquest of Canaan. And this is a good time for me to remind you that indeed, not all of Canaan had been conquered as we begin Judges. That it was the duty of each of the 12 tribes, exception being the tribe of Levi, who was not counted as among the 12, to finish driving the Canaanites out of their allotted territory. It was this understanding that had caused Joshua such great anguish and frustration. Because for a long time, seven of the tribes refused to accept their territories because it meant the hard and dangerous job of battling the various Canaanites fell to them. Now, this by no means meant that the leader of the tribe of Judah, was appointed at this time to take over for Joshua. However, we're soon going to see Judah will play a special and somewhat self-sacrificing role among his brother tribes. The first thing Judah did was to go to Simeon, to the tribe, not to the person, and ask them to fight alongside of them. There was a very good and logical reason for this. As verse 3 says, Simeon and Judah were brothers. Leah was their mother. So they were full brothers. And as we're learning in the Torah and later books, it was most usual for a man to have multiple wives and concubines, and so only sometimes were brothers and sisters full brothers and sisters. As often as not, they were what we today called step or half brothers and sisters. Therefore, Judah and Simeon essentially signed up for mutual assistance, and it was natural that they would, since they had the same mother. Now, since Simeon's territory was more or less carved out of the center of Judah's, it also made sense for them to join Judah. Now, such an arrangement would have been practically unthinkable if it had been for a very close family relationship. Even so, in only a few more generations, the tribe of Judah would largely absorb the tribe of Simeon. By the time of King Solomon, Simeon no longer had its own territory. And although some retained a memory of their Simeonite tribal identity, most didn't any longer. Well, in verse 4, we find the coalition forces of Judah and Simeon waging battle against the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Now, at this point in history, the term Canaanites referred in a non-specific way to all the various tribes and peoples who lived in the land of Canaan, even if they technically were not from the line of Canaan. Perizzites are thought by many scholars to not even be a specific tribe, but rather that they were just people who occupied the hill country. Now, this encounter that they had was against a fellow called Adonai Bezek. Now, Adonai Bezek is not a person's name. It's a title, and it means Lord of Bezek. Now, Bezek was probably the family name of a long-established dynasty. So when authority was passed from one ruler to the next, each successive ruler would have been called Adonai Bezek. It's like saying King of England, with the obvious question being, which one? Therefore, we really don't know the name, the actual name of this individual. We just know where the place of Bezek was actually located. Now, as the battle ensued, Judah and Simeon were winning. So the lord of Bezek fled. That was pretty usual for a king. They found him, they caught him, and they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. But they didn't kill him. He was really rather philosophical about this unpleasant turn of events, because he says that he treated 70 enemy kings exactly the same way. So God just returned the favor. Now, really, this is a statement of what's called lex talionis, or eye for an eye. So God just returned, as he said, returned the favor. It was proportional justice, and this was generally understood and practiced among Middle Eastern cultures. Now, don't think, by the way, that the use of the term God here is directly referring to the Israelite God, Yehovah. The Hebrew word that's being used is Elohim, and that was a generic term used for any God. Adonai Bezek was merely saying that his God or some God was repaying his lack of mercy with retribution. Further, 70 is not a number that we should probably take literally. 70 means a great but unspecified number in this context. Why cut off the thumbs and big toes of this lord? Because by doing so, such a man became impotent in battle. Without thumbs, he couldn't hold a sword. He couldn't shoot a bow. He couldn't be effective in hand-to-hand combat. He couldn't drive a chariot. Without his big toes, he lost most of his mobility. He could walk with care, but he sure couldn't run. Therefore, he couldn't flee from danger. So even if this captured king eventually escaped from Judah, his lack of thumbs and big toes meant his days of leadership were over. That he died in Jerusalem is referring to natural causes. He wasn't executed, at least that was anywhere recorded. Well, now next in verse 8, we find Judah and Simeon fighting against Jerusalem and capturing it from the Jebusites. Now, we're told that the city was burned. Now, this was a common practice, and actually, this was only keeping in line with the law of Harem, the law of the ban, whereby since this was holy war, then all the spoils belonged to God. And the only way to give God a city is to send it up to him in smoke by burning it. Unfortunately, Israel would only hold on to Jerusalem for a short time. Jerusalem was not in either Judah's or Simeon's territory. It was in Benjamin's. So what we find later in verse 21 is that after its capture, it was quickly turned over to Benjamin. But Benjamin either had little interest in holding it or was just incapable. And they lost it right back to the Jebusites, and it stayed that way until the time of David. Now, what tended to happen at this point in history was that an Israelite tribe would capture some Canaanite city, but would offer the inhabitants to stay as subjects and as serfs that would pay tribute, taxes, to the victorious Hebrews. It didn't always work out so well. And Jerusalem was one of those instances. Judah and Simeon fought for it. They took it properly. They turned it over to Benjamin. And Benjamin allowed the Jebusites to stay. Thus, the few Benjamites who did settle in Jerusalem soon found themselves as the minority to the more dominant Jebusite king. This story would be repeated ad infinitum in the land of Canaan. Something we need to plant firmly in our memories for future reference is this expanding contrast between the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Here we find Judah in victory after victory, and we are told that the reason for their success was that the Lord was with them. On the other hand is Benjamin, whose lot is failure. Judah wins Jerusalem, Benjamin loses it. King Saul, first king of Israel, was from the tribe of Benjamin, and we're pretty well aware of his tragic character and failures. The second king was David. From what tribe? Judah. And we're equally aware of his close to God's heart character and his stunning victories. Well, next, Judah and Simeon attack Hebron, also known then as Kiriat Arba. Double, even triple names were typical in that day, as they reflected the changing hands of cities to various nations who spoke various languages. Kiriat Arba means city of four. That referred to a confederation of four city-states who allied for mutual protection and economic gain. Hebron means confederacy or association, which is essentially the same idea as Kiriat Arba. Sheshai, Achiman, and Talmai were the lords over three of the city-states that helped form this four-city confederation, and they were all sons of Anak. That means they were Anakim. Now, it's that race of very large men who produced the giant Goliath. Now, after that, Judah and Simeon made war upon Debir, also known as Kiriat Sefer. Kiriat Sefer means city of the book. But there were a number of Kiriat Sefers because it was a more of a description than it was a name. Sefer means book, but it also means records, like birth records or accounting records. And once a region or a confederacy got large enough, they would designate one city as the common place where all important records for their society were kept. So it was given the title of Kiriat Sefer, the city of records. Well, the next several verses retell a story told in Joshua 15 about a clan leader of Judah named Caleb, the same person who was one of the 12 spies who scouted out Canaan for Moses and then came back with a good report. Caleb assigned the task of taking Debir to Othniel, the son of Kenaz. Now, it's pretty interesting to understand that Caleb and Othniel, a close family member, actually came from Edomite heritage. Edomites were descended from Esau. Somehow, Caleb's ancestors became part of the tribe of Judah, even became the most powerful clan within Judah. This is something we should not easily forget. See, because it demonstrates just how early the Israelite people became a diverse and genealogically mixed nation. In return for taking Debir, Caleb gave his daughter Aksah to Othniel, who was actually probably her uncle. And as part of her dowry, she received land. And then later on, rights to water wells, which is a terribly important matter in an area of the Negev that had decent soil but precious little water available. Now, this interesting summary of history continues in verse 16 with a reference to Moses' father-in-law's clan of the Canaan or the Kenites, which is not to be confused with the Kenizzites. The Kenites were a clan of a tribe of Midian. They lived where the mountain of the burning bush raised up out of the desert floor. Moses' wife's side of the family migrated under the protection of Judah and Simeon to an area of called the city of date palms. And they settled. Now, there's no agreement on exactly where this even is. Usually, it's thought to be Jericho. Others insist it's south of Jericho. Could be. Anyway, Judah and Simeon continued in their victories by warring against Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Yes, think about this. This is the same Gaza we hear about on the news day and night. Same one. Is that wild? 3,000 years ago, we're reading about Israel warring against Gaza, and they still are today. Amazing. But as of the time of the opening verses of the book of Judges, the Philistines had not yet established themselves in those places. Therefore, it was some of the various Canaanite peoples who still inhabited them. Then we're told that while Judah was successful in taking more of the hill country away from other Canaanites, they were unable to drive them out of the valley areas. And that was due to the use of iron chariots by the enemy. Look, simply put, chariots need relatively flat ground to operate on. They were near useless on steep hills or rocky places. Therefore, the Canaanites couldn't use their most feared weapons platform, a chariot, in the hills, and so they lost their advantage to Judah. The area of the plains and valleys was another matter altogether, and the fearsome chariots enabled the Canaanites to hang on to some of the enormous fertile valleys. Now, verse 22 changes venues and speaks for the first time in the book of Judges about the house of Joseph. The house of Joseph technically consisted of the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim. But often in the Bible, it is only Ephraim that is meant by the house of Joseph. At other times, it's hard to tell if it's one or both that's meant. Probably here it means Ephraim because the happenings are either in or near their territory. Now, I want to remind you again that all this attacking we see on Israel's part was supposed to be happening. The Lord expected them to fight these battles. What he did not expect the 12 tribes to do was to make treaties with the enemy, to find reasons to live peacefully with the people they conquered. The Lord's explicit instructions were to drive out or kill all the inhabitants of Canaan. The lone exceptions would be those who dropped their allegiance to their nations and to their gods and worshiped Jehovah instead. Well, how can I bypass this without making note of what's happening in Israel today? I mean, sadly, the current generations of Israelis are victims of an incomplete conquest from over 3,000 years ago. And the problem then is exactly as it is today, a refusal to believe God. The men of Joshua's day and forward wanted to insert their own sense of morality and mercy and purpose into the equation, and as though somehow their opinion was on equal footing with Jehovah's commandments. And once in the land, they considered their neighbors. They saw that they looked and behaved very much as themselves, realized that probably among the Israelites were family ties between many of the inhabitants of Canaan, so they came to the conclusion that living with the Canaanites was a better, wiser, kinder, perhaps more pragmatic approach than fighting them to the death. with the only possible outcomes being driving these Canaanites out from their homes and their land or annihilating them outright. Let's face it. What might we have done confronted with that choice? Well, I think we have the answer to that rhetorical question if we're honest enough to face it. See, while at the same time, the modern church glints their eyes and looks disapprovingly at the barbaric instructions of the Old Testament towards the Canaanites, the God of Israel towards the Canaanites, we tend to simultaneously criticize the Israelites for not fully carrying out the orders to annihilate the Canaanites. We say, see, if only you'd done it. So today, in the ongoing and yet to be completed battle for Canaan, that is the modern day situation that Israel finds itself in, the bulk of Christians tend to side with the idea of ceasefires, of aid and even-handed treatment for Israel's Arab and Muslim enemies, offering understanding and sympathy when those same enemies demand another piece of Israel for their own, and still harbor the grand hope for a lasting treaty of peace and cooperation between Israel and their foes that each can live and let live. We then point to our loving Messiah Yeshua and declare that the Old Testament God's aspirations and demands of a land rid of people who oppose Israel and oppose the God of Israel has been now declared null and void. Tolerance for everyone and everything is the new aim. And the New Testament God wants peace at any price. Israel is also caught up in their desire to see the end of war. So they continue in ways, the ways of their ancestors, and declare that their sense of humanitarianism and fairness trumps Jehovah's commandments concerning the conquest of the promised land. This is the cause for the intractable Middle Eastern problem. It's not oil. It's not really even Islam. It's not the UN and it's not the EU. It is disobedience. It is disbelief, not only among Jews, but also among Christians. That's what stalls the final resolution. It's not inadequate diplomacy or a lack of sincerity. I mean, I want to warn all who are listening that to support the idea of Israel giving up land to their enemies, this is offensive to the Lord. Those who want Israel to accept a peace agreement that has Israel conceding rights to the Temple Mount, to those who worship a false god, Allah, so that they can maintain a pagan worship site there, are just simply complicit in idolatry. Those Israelites who seek these things are denying the covenant of Abraham and are saying that the Lord God is wrong and he didn't mean what he said and he's just incapable about bringing it about. But let me also say something that may surprise you. The Battle of Armageddon is but the final battle of the holy war for Canaan. The battle that the leaders who followed Joshua, then David, then Solomon, and now the elected government of Israel have all decided is just not worth the fighting. We Christians sing joyfully of the coming of Jesus. We pray that today is that day. But somehow we cannot connect it that this same Messiah who suffered and died as a meek lamb for our sakes is going to be leading this final battle for the conquest of Canaan. He will be as ruthless as Jehovah, who expected Joshua and those who followed him to be, but they refused. And not one person who withholds their allegiance to the God of Israel and his Messiah are going to remain alive on the face of this planet when Yeshua finally lays down his sword of vengeance. The conquest for the land of Canaan is not over. It's happening right before our eyes, and I'm sorry to say the worst is yet to come. Even more is its effect that is expanding to include the entire earth. It may turn out that as Yeshua's followers, we will not be able to fully escape all of the consequences of this 3,400-year-long battle, but we can sure choose to be on the right side. Well, in verse 22, the tribe of the house of Joseph, probably meaning Ephraim, attacks the city of Beit El that at one time was known as Luz. The city of Ai was very nearby. In fact, Ai and Beit El, if not sister cities, may well have been the same city, just slightly relocated after a destruction. And when Ephraim approached the city, a man of Beit El decided to cooperate with some Ephraimite spies and showed them a good way to steal into the city. In return, the Ephraimite spies promised to let the man and all of his family survive the coming onslaught. This has tones of the Jericho attack and Rahab, the prostitute innkeeper, from the early parts of the book of Joshua, but that's where all the similarity between these two stories ends. This man of Beit El expressed no interest in Israel's God, and his only motive was self-preservation, to the point he was willing to commit treason to save his own skin. There was no honor in what happened here, as there was when Rahab had converted before she met the spies, and her allegiance to the God of Israel was at the heart of her decision. We get an interesting and an instructional footnote in the next verse that says that this man of Beit El went to the country of the Hittites, which, by the way, is modern-day Turkey, and he built a city there, and he called it Luz. In other words, after he turned his own home city over to destruction at the hands of Israel, he went and led the construction of a new city, and he gave it the same name as his former one. Guilt? Probably. Well, from here on to the end of chapter 1, we get mostly a list of failed attempts by various Israelite tribes to drive out various groups of Canaanites from their territories. Basically, this is setting the playing field for what we're going to see happen in a chapter or so in Judges. That's why chapter 1 is set out the way it is. We are getting some context so that we understand what's going to happen from here on now, chapter 2 and beyond. Manasseh, which was the other house of Joseph, could not drive out the Canaanites from Beit Shan and the surrounding areas. Many of you have been to Beit Shan and the extensive Roman ruins there. Neither could they terminate the Canaanites' hold on Megiddo, a very important fortress, because it lies on a major trade route. It's actually at a crossroads, as well as it's the place that overlooks an extensive portion of the Jezreel Valley. We're told that in time Israel was able to subdue them sufficiently that they used them as forced labor. But here again, we see how the new Israeli mindset had taken hold. For this generation of Israelites, the issue was expediency and economics. And God's purposes lost out to these weak and selfish desires. We're told Ephraim failed at Gezer. Zebulun followed their brothers' ways and allowed the enemy to remain, but used them to their economic advantage. Asher followed suit in their territory. Naphtali made peace and lived intertwined with Canaanites in some of their territory, but was able to subdue them in other parts. The last couple of verses set the stage for the migration of Dan away from their territory, that was contiguous with Judah's, west of Judah, Now, Dan not only couldn't defeat the people in their territory, the Amorites who lived there ran Dan out into the hills. And we find that Dan eventually moved north to the border of Lebanon. Judah soon annexed Dan's former territory, and they were able to defeat the Amorites, though again Judah elected to use the Amorites as forced labor rather than to follow God's instructions to rid the land of them. In the end, we can say this about the state of the 12 tribes as a result of all that we've discussed today. First of all, Israel simply couldn't drive the Canaanites out, so the Canaanites dug in. And Israel's mindset moved from conqueror to diplomat, from sole possessor of the land to cohabitation with those who God found unacceptable to him. Second of all, Israel found their freedom of movement highly impeded because their holds on the territories were spotty. Third, even more problematic in the long run, was that the wickedness of the Canaanites' worship of false gods remained intact. So it represented an acute danger to Israel's purity and holiness and a daily temptation to dilute their devotion to Yahweh. And fourth, Israel decided it was better to create and maintain good relationships than to eject the Canaanites from the land. In fact, they saw that in many ways, the Canaanites they were able to subdue made a ready and usable labor force. So to them, it made no sense to send them away. I'm going to conclude today with just this short comment. The peace that men construct is not the peace that God instructs. For men, peace is invariably the result of one of two things: war or compromise. And in war, at least until our era, one side won and the other side lost. And one side subjugated the other and forced the subjugated to comply. Now more than ever, it is a compromise type of peace that men seek. That's not the type of peace that Yahweh is speaking of in his word. His peace is absolute. It doesn't involve compromise. And it comes from men's free will choice to serve the Lord as he demands to be served, and absolutely nothing else. Israel saw nothing wrong in their approach to settling Canaan. Israel saw nothing wrong in their approach to battle, their new goal being make peace with the neighbors. So they participated in their neighbors' festivals, in their customs. They gave respect to their former enemies' beliefs, even to their false gods. Let me stop there. How many times have we heard, been told, even by Christian pastors, we need to at least show respect to the Muslim God? At least show respect. Really? Really? Show respect to a pagan God. But you know what? They enjoyed a measure of rest and fruitfulness from it. It was mostly man-made, and it bore little resemblance to what godly rest and fruitfulness looked like. This is what we tend to be seeking when we show respect to false religions and false gods. And look at Israel today. And see what's happened to them for all the respect they've showed to false religions and false gods. How much has it helped them? How much has it helped us? Intermarriage between Canaanites and Hebrews became an everyday affair. With little resistance, not much thought. And both sides saw it as really a pretty good thing. Israel was blind to their condition. They would not accept that they had broken faith with their God. You know why? They felt so good about themselves. They felt so good about their ability to contrive their own morality without the direction of the Lord. We'll see how the Lord feels about all this in our next lesson.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.